Tango Tango Papa 1791, November 7, 2013.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from somewhere in Ohio. I'm not exactly sure of which town it is. I've got about, about 208 more miles to drive. I could have driven more this evening, actually 216 miles according to the GPS. I could have driven somewhat more this evening, but I'm sort of in between Cleveland and Erie, Pennsylvania, and sometimes these truck stops fill up pretty good. Now, it just so happens tonight that where I've stopped at, there's this exit. There is a Flying J truck stop and a Pilot truck stop at the same exit, and they both have a fair number of, upwards of 150 or 160 parking spots. And so far, this particular truck stop, there are still quite a few parking spots left, so I could have probably went on and maybe found a place to park that would have been a bit closer, but in the end, I'll just leave a little bit, I'll leave here a little bit earlier than I would have if I would have been able to drive. I could have driven maybe an hour or two more at the most, depending on where I was, would be able to stop at. What I don't want to do is end up in a situation, and I have ended up in the situation before, where I'm kind of running out of time and I can't find a place to parking spot. And that that's not a pleasant situation to be in. So would rather avoid that. And like I say, I just leave here. The delivery appointment's at 3 o'clock, and they do have parking, according to my Qualcomm directions. They do have parking at the receiver. So I'll leave here. Let's say I leave here at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock. So, and I can figure 4 hours worth of driving. So let's say I leave at 9, so 10, 11, 12, 1, and that gives me a couple of hours leeway with the delivery appointment being at 3 p.m. So that should work out. So it was rainy kind of all day today. I've been in the rain. Now I think the rain, there's probably a little bit of drizzle that's still continuing, so everything's still wet. And it was mostly a drizzle. There were a few areas where it was kind of raining, but it never really was very hard. But I've pretty much been in the rain. Spent the night at Effingham, Illinois, and I've pretty much been in the rain all day long until I stopped here. So, and it's been about between 50 and 60 degrees. And I don't know. I think when I looked earlier, at least where I was at, it was saying that the temperature was going to get down in the 40s. But right now, it's still relatively warmer. I've got the parked here. I've got the windows down just a little bit, and on each side, and I'm still comfortable here in the truck. So, of course, I've got the lights on in here, so I can see and what have you, and those along with me do generate some heat. So, but probably, I might wake up in the middle of the night and have to start the truck, which is actually pretty easy because I've got the truck. This truck has the optimized idle, so I can prepare it by engaging the part of the optimized idle, and then if I the final step is to turn on the thermostat here in the back. It's sort of like a house thermostat. If I turn that on, then that will cause the, depending on what the temperature is, it'll cause the engine to start, and then the heat will come on and warm it up in here. So, you know, and there's times where I'll do that, especially if it's kind of cool in the morning, then, you know, that's what I did this morning, in fact. So, in any case, you know, I was talking a little bit in a podcast last night about Saul Alinsky and community agitators, organizers, and what have you. And I've got some various pieces of audio that I want to play. Now, I don't know if I'm going to play all of them in this podcast. I've got some where Saul Alinsky, there's one where Saul Alinsky's being interviewed by William F. Buckley. And then there's another one where there's this fellow named Studs Terkel was interviewing Saul Alinsky. Now, I think all, you know, Saul Alinsky's certainly dead, along with William F. Buckley, and I think probably Studs Terkel is dead as well. And then I have some other things, too. And I, like I say, I don't know if I'll have time to play. It just kind of depends. I don't know if I'll have time to play those in the podcast or not. But the idea of community organizer, community agitator, it only works, and it works the best, with people that have character flaws. And you have a group of people that already have the groupthink. They're already sort of engaged in groupthink. And all you have to do is agitate them, find the elements that agitate their groupthink, cause them to resent more. And then the organizing part is taking control of them for your own agenda. And in this case, the agenda, they want to, basically implement socialism or communism. And it only works, you know, the flaw in this system, and it's hardly a flaw, at least, you know, in our present day and age. The only flaw, the way to put a stop to it, an immediate stop to this, you have to learn how to not resent. And that's done at the individual level, and you have to want to learn the truth. You have to want to know the truth. And it's pretty apparent to me that most people, the last thing they want to know is the truth. They'll run from the truth. They'll do anything but listen. That's the last thing, despite what they say. The last thing they want is a real answer. The last thing they want is the truth, because the truth is painful, and the truth would, the truth would really destroy the wrong side of their ego. And so that's why true, you know, if you can, it's so easy to corrupt someone, it's so easy to screw them up, and, you know, because they're already, we come into this world with this proclivity to want to play God. The wrong side of our ego is already sort of ready to engage the world, and so it becomes very easy to separate, you know, to energize, essentially, the wrong side of people's egos, because we come into the world wanting to play God, and we do that via the wrong side of our ego, through resenting and then being proud of it. And so, it's easy, it's just incredibly easy to, you know, for someone that's ruthless to agitate that, and then take the power, and then they organize. You can organize people to do anything. The only prerequisite is that you have to be without conscience, and you have to be perfectly, willing to destroy people and have absolutely no regard and no real humanity towards them. And but it's really sort of the ultimate form, in a sense, it's sort of the ultimate form of where this man playing God idea goes, because it has to turn into groupthink. And then you have people that know that and take advantage of it. And it really does have to be that way, because we are being put to the test. And the only way to put, if you're God and you've created human beings and so on and so forth, and you want to create a creature that can actually really love you and really want you, really want your, really want your the identity that you offer, etc., 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 as I've talked about many times, if you really want to create that creature, you have to make it possible for just the absolute worst to happen. And, so that's how we end up with hell on earth. So in any case, I'm going to jump right into this. I'm going to play the, which one of these should I play the first? I'm going to play the William F. Buckley interview with Saul Alinsky. So here we go. Now, I may have to adjust the volume up a bit. I'm recording this on the new iPad, the iPad Air, using this program called Boss Jock. And I've made recorded about 3 podcasts on it so far. Pretty happy with the results. But one thing that it does sort of lack is that I do have an Ubercaster on the Mac. I can come in after the fact and fix the audio levels. And with this, I can't really fix it after the fact, and I'm sort of limited on what I can do as the recording is sort of taking place. So, in any case, here's the William F. Buckley, Saul Alinsky interview.
Mr. Saul Alinsky, who was born in Chicago in 1909, will come to your town, as he has to 40 others, to organize the poor. That may mean an end to orderly traffic, might mean sit-ins in City Hall, the cultivation of racial animosities, but Mr. Alinsky claims that's the way to get the toilets fixed in the slum buildings and to bring pride and a sense of dignity to the poor people, something like the sense of dignity which presumably Sitting Bull and his people felt after a massacre. You do have fascinating general notions. For instance, you said, I'll steal before I'll take charity.
No.
Now, suppose I'm the person you're going to steal it from. Would you consult my feelings if I were to say to you before stealing from me, please won't you just take it? Or is it the act of stealing that gives you the satisfaction that you require?
Oh, of course not. You know better than that. It isn't the act of stealing.
Is charity. Why don't you take charity then?
Well, you know what I meant by charity. Just going to getting welfare handouts and...
But welfare handouts are the product
place,
of philanthropy.
When I talk about power, and I'm using it strictly as it's defined in Webster's Under Bridge as the ability to act, I'm saying people do not get power except when they take it, or when they're strong enough so that the other side gives it up, or at least gives up its what would be a compromise arrangement. Compromise, to me, is not a dirty word. I think if I had to define the whole democratic process in one word, I would use that word. As far as the little example you gave, which is so academic, in the first place, if you're going to steal anything from somebody, he isn't going to be around to say to you, why don't you
sometimes
take
they are. It happens every day in New York.
You know, yeah, I read your column on that one.
Okay, yeah, you say your money, your money or your life. The Jack Benny says, "Well, I have to think it over." But they're often around, and in effect, you have that call it a choice. But you do have a feeling. You said a moment ago just now that you only get power if you wrest it from somebody.
Yeah, well, let's. You only get power as a reaction to a threat. I think.
But that's not true.
Oh, of course it
suppose
is.
Suppose everybody in this room decided to nominate you as our leader. You would then have power over us. This doesn't mean that you wrested it from us.
If everybody in this room decided to nominate me as their leader, I wouldn't have any power to do anything.
That has nothing to do with it. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? If we pledged our allegiance to you.
I'd have a bunch of kids and you. Well, your columns might be of some help for a while.
No, but suppose
you that's all. I'm looking at it very pragmatically.
Suppose you were in a position to deploy us in any way that you chose, we having decided to give you that power, why haven't we actually vouchsafed you something?
Well, in the first place, I have never taken that kind of power.
That's not a relevant answer. I'm trying to understand your philosophy here, and I find it difficult to do.
Well, do you want to understand my philosophy?
Desperately.
You do? Well, then, can you sort of be desperately silent for about 1 minute or 2 minutes? All right, I'll go with you.
Three.
All right, as far as I'm concerned, living in the world as it is, you don't have the choice of what's best. Every judgment that is made on the basis of alternatives. On that basis, I find myself totally committed to the fact that a free and open, what we call, roughly speaking, a democratic society is the best way of life that we have. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm willing to buy the Churchill definition that it may be this a lousy way of life, but it's the best way that we know of. Now, I find, in terms of my own acceptance and understanding of our political situation, I find myself very much in agreement with the thinking of the early revolutionary leaders. I'm thinking of men like Madison, Jay Hamilton, etc., who I think were extraordinarily politically sophisticated and very well read and very thoughtful in terms of the implications of their actions and very much aware of the fact that they were of the world that they were living in was not, and they weren't getting it mixed up with the world as they would like it to be, but that this was a jump-off point that they were heading towards a future where mankind could always be improving or living a happier life full of potentials for, and you find yourself drifting into cliches here, of achieving his own dignity, freedom, equality, etc. Now, the one thing that they were concerned about in this kind of a life is that while things would always be changing, that basically, whatever future there was to the future of an open society, it rested in the fact of having as many people involved as citizens, being able to act as citizens, able to act power.
Freedom is participation in power, I agree, yeah.
All right. And that if we ever ran into a situation in this country where a large sector of our population was disenfranchised politically and economically, etc. And I'm not talking about equality in terms of equal income or anything else of that sort. But if we ever ran into that kind of situation, that it would very well become malignant and bring down the hopes for the future. As a matter of fact, de Tocqueville makes the same point on it in his speculations of future, this new way of life. Now, what is involved here is, and I have to answer you on two levels here. One is a commitment to the development of the kind of the combination of circumstances in those sectors of our society that are disenfranchised, whereby through organization, which is really a synonym for ability to act in this world, the only reason people ever organize, in fact, in order to be able to put things into practice, ideas that they have, in order to belong, in order to have the power to be part of the
to body. Maximize the leverage, yeah.
Yeah. Or to get leverage to even begin with, where they don't have any.
You got leverage if you can vote.
Yeah, but there were large sectors of our population that weren't even able to vote.
You're talking about Rochester?
No, I'm talking about Mississippi. About the South. I'm talking about the whole basis in many sectors of this country in terms of the Civil Rights Revolution. You have to have that. Even have to have it, if I might digress for a moment, on the simple situation that, let's say, people are organized. You do not have that complex, called a political complex, and I'm using political strictly in the Greek sense here, whereby through getting together, through having a convention, through having a election of officers, agreement on policies and so forth, that they can turn to other sectors of society and say, here are our representatives. These are the men for you to deal with and the democratic give and take and hauling, decision making, etc. Without this, which I think is a primary element in the democratic mix, the whole democratic society begins to founder. Let's take Detroit right after the riots that occurred. Let's assume that the powers that be deciding, as they did decide when they got together afterwards, we've got to deal with the representatives of the black ghettos. And they turn to the black ghettos and say, send us your representatives. Who's going to come forward?
I think what's most interesting about yourself, at least most people, is this distinctive appeal that you have to certain types of people who recognize that there is a problem of the poor. Now, you appeal to some of them because you have this disdain for welfarism, mm-hmm. As suggested by that ultimatum of yours, that you rather steal than receive welfare. Now, this appeals to a lot of people sort of conservative-minded, who are against welfare because they do believe that there is going on in this country a sort of institutionalization of welfare, that we ought to get out of it, and that to be essentially human, you've got to make your own way. So you appeal to them. On the other hand, you appeal, they would be conservatives in a way, you appeal also to liberals and radicals, because yours is a highly non-rhetorical approach. You actually want to organize the poor, and you want to cause them to demand things. And you seem to be utterly either unconscious, or if not unconscious, at least insensible to the normal niceties of approach. When you want something, you simply want it.
That isn't my wanting.
Well, when you figure out they want it, yeah. Now, for instance, you were perfectly prepared, as I understand it, to close down City Hall a while ago in Chicago. Just send wave after wave of people there just to close it down. Just make it impossible for the mayor to go in or the mayor to go out, or the sheriff to go in or the sheriff to go out.
And I've been involved in so many of these things, I'm trying to remember which
one
that was.
Woodlawn, yeah. And you're perfectly prepared to cause a tremendous amount of commotion out in the suburban areas where landlords live, so as to force the neighbors, as you put it, themselves to put pressure on the delinquent landlords to make those reforms.
Well, that was pure pragmatism, because people only do the right things for the wrong reasons. And I wanted to get the white neighbors to put the pressure on their white slum landlord in order to get rid of the Negro pickets that were in the community. They weren't doing it for equality.
Yeah, that's once again, it seems to me that you obtrude into the discussion your own essential cynicism.
That's not cynicism, that's realism.
No, but it isn't.
Come on.
I know a lot of people do things they don't want to do at all. And they do them simply because they think it's the right thing to do. I'll introduce you to some, if you like, later on.
Are they all conservative?
No, they're of every stripe. A lot of them are liberals, some of them radicals, some of them are communists. Can I quote you exactly? Quote, "There is no evolution without revolution, and there are no revolutions without conflict, and this is the line which separates liberals from radicals."
Where'd you get that from?
Harper's.
All right.
I'll show it to you after, if you like.
No, I'll buy it.
Yeah. Now, isn't this once again one more expression of your belief that what progress is made by some sort of a Hegelian sense of controversy, conflict, antithesis, and so on? You just finished discussing the fact that there exists in Chicago now something that is substantially better than was there 5, 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And then you say, don't you understand the reason it came into being was because of the Woodlawn operation? And sure, the Woodlawn operation involved conflict. It necessarily had to. And I'm asking whether or not progress can't be made without a conflict.
No, I don't believe so. I think that the most insidious, the most subversive force that has ever entered the American scene has been what I would call Madison Avenue public relations, middle class moral hygiene, which has made the word conflict a nasty word, and controversy a very nasty word. So the people are fired off of mass media for controversy.
But don't you think that reason? Well, I have a stake in the toleration of controversy. But I want to ask you this. Can't one achieve progress by reason? Or must it be by a conflict of force?
Even on the basis of reason. The moment you come up with a new idea, it promptly challenges the prevailing sacred cow of the older idea, and you've got a conflict going on. I think that controversy is a matrix of everything creative that comes out of life.
We got Medicare in this country, and we got as a result of a lot of discussion. Now, mightn't Alinsky students have felt that you'd need to shoot a few doctors or let a few people die for lack of medical attention before you'd have the kind of conflict that's necessary to midwife Medicare? And I'm asking, why
Buckley,
can't you
I've been fascinated by your eyes in previous shows I've watched, Anna. Will you look at me and tell me whether you believe what you're saying?
What I'm trying to do is extract from you disbelief in what people understand you to be believing, but perhaps because I'm terribly refreshed that you're constantly shocked that people at quotations I throw at you of things you've
well,
said.
I'm not shocked.
I'm delighted. This shows great progress.
I'm just correcting some of the misquotations.
if you're saying therefore that conflict is what we're doing right now, then I agree with you that conflict is probably necessary to the changing of any point of view. But most people understand you to be saying something much more.
What their understanding is closer to it than just our discussion. I don't want to take a pass on.
Yeah.
I'm saying very unreservedly that all progress comes as a response to a threat, and the reaction to the threat is when you get progress. I'm saying that that all actions of history have come that way.
That's
it doesn't
not true.
Necessarily have to be violence.
Why? But that's not true. What was the threat? What is the relevant threat, let's say, when John decides to marry Jane?
Okay, so that was William F. Buckley sort of interviewing Saul Alinsky and... I don't know, you know, they kind of cut it off there, and that really wasn't a great interview, you know, because the kind of the back and forth that seemed like there was really no meat sort of going on, but it is what it is, I guess. Now this next one that I'm going to play is this fellow, Studs Terkel. And I guess, you know, he was, I think he's long dead. But he was also interviewing Saul Alinsky. So go ahead and play that. So here's Studs Terkel interviewing Saul Alinsky.
If you were to describe Saul as a professional agitator, what would your reaction be to that description?
That's okay with me. You left out one word, Studs. Professional outside agitator. You see, you got to be an outside agitator to begin with, because agitators very rarely come up from the inside. Because if you come up from the inside, one of two things happens to you. Either you get knocked off, or you get co-opted. That's the reason all agitators are outside agitators. And, you see, when you're out to really get change, every community, every place is organized. When sociologists talk about social disorganization or that communities are disorganized, that's what they're talking about. You can go into the creditiest community. It's got a policy racket going. It's got a syndicate going. It's got a political organization in there that's crooked as hell. And they're being exploited if it's a company town. But it's organized, you know? It's a contradiction in terms to say that there's such a thing as a disorganized community. So that the job of an agitator is first to... it's really not organizing a movement, he's reorganizing it. First, he's got to change the whole pattern. He's got to disorganize it. That's why he's an agitator. And after he disorganizes it, then he reorganizes it.
So, we're coming to now something. then this man who enters a community, this man, this outside quote-unquote agitator, has entered a community that is organized to begin with.
That's right.
And organized for what? And why is he there? See, organized for what? The community.
Well, the community is organized on a certain pattern of values. You can call it an exploitation of the many by the few over there. Call it whatever you want to. The organizer brings in another set of values. Now, to say that an organizer comes in who is just in there as sort of a blotter, that he's going in for just participatory democracy. He doesn't have any ideas. He's just going to be a servant to the people, of the masses, so to speak. He will just reflect what they want. It's just a lot of romantic crap. If an organizer doesn't have ideas as to how he wants to change that thing, and more important, if he doesn't have the sophistication and the experience to know how to get it done. See, there's a big difference between the what's that you want to get in life and the how you go about getting it. If you don't know the how about getting it, you're never going to get the what's. I always used to say that if any smart organizer had come up before the Oracle at Delphi, and the Oracle always sounded off with her usual proverbial business of know thyself, you know. A smart organizer would look at her and say, okay, Oracle, now how the hell do I go about doing it? Don't tell me what I have to get. Tell me how to get it, because unless I know the how, the what is just rhetoric, you know. And I imagine the Oracle would have had a fit, you know, would have said one question allowed only to a customer or something, yeah. Get thee gone.
Yeah.
That organizer's got to have ideas. If he doesn't have ideas, when he comes in there, if he doesn't know how and what to do, the only thing that his presence does is where the population was 100,000 before he walked in, it now becomes 100,001. That's all. It doesn't make any difference there. He can only come in on the basis really of an invitation from the community. I go to Houston, I do nothing but to lecture at the University of Houston. I get at the airport, the whole clan is out there in full regalia. The mayor is all over the front page of the newspaper. He's going to investigate the university for inviting this radical down to speak to the university. The John Birch Society's got a mass picket line out there. The next morning, there's a big delegation of blacks inviting me to come in because they'd never seen the everybody they hate is so uptight. But now, if you haven't got that kind of rep, you got to go about working your way in. And one of the basic things here is whether you really, I should stop and say this, does, that this is one field on which you cannot pull a con game or snow job. If you don't like people, they goddamn well soon know it. You know, you can pull a fast job if you're selling a vacuum cleaner or something. You're only going to be with the guy for an hour, selling him a house or a car. But when you're selling people and working with them, you're working with them for hours, for days, for weeks, for months. Sooner or later, they sense it, you know. So, if as long as you respect the dignity of people, then they'll respond to you. Now, that sounds like an old cliche. But as long as I respect you, for example, I can't come to you and say, now, Studs, this is the way you get this thing done. Because what I'm really saying to you is, look, you dumb son of a bitch, you've been sitting around here for years, and I got to come along and tell you now, this is the way you get it done. So naturally, you're going to resent it. You see, freedom of choice, and freedom is part of dignity, is really the right to make the choice. I go into a neighborhood. I run into you. You're on welfare, you know? You're standing on the corner. So we get into a conversation. So I say, where do you live? Over there. Well, where do you expect me to live? I'm on relief. Well, what do you want me to live in, a 14-karat gold palace, you know? No, but Jesus, you pay anything to live there? Oh, come on. Trying to be funny? Well, no, I don't want to be funny about it. Jesus, place looks like it's loaded with rats and cockroaches, everything. You damn well know what it is. What would happen if you didn't pay your rent? What would happen? They'd throw me out my kids and everybody else. What do you mean? Yeah. What would happen if nobody paid their rent over there? Why, they'd... Well, Jesus, they'd have a little trouble throwing us all out, wouldn't they?
Okay, so that was sort of short. I'm going to have to dig around and see if I can find... I might be able to find a longer version of this Studs Terkel Saul Alinsky interview. I need to do some digging, you know, because he's interesting to listen to, you know, but he's got some strange, you know, he's got some strange ideas, you know, and I think the guy's kind of without conscience, but so in any case, I'll do some more digging and see if I can find some more thing, you know, some longer versions of him being interviewed. So there's also, I've also got another piece of audio that I want to play. And this is, as nearly as I can tell, it's a guy that's talking in front of an audience, and he's talking about sort of the idea of how to change society, sort of, you know, overwhelm, you know, kind of tear it down. And, you know, and Saul Alinsky was talking about that a little bit in this clip that we just listened to. Sort of destroy what's there so you can rebuild it in whatever your image is, whatever you want to. And so this is sort of talking about how to destroy the system, destroy the system so that you can you know, overwhelm it to the point where then, you know, people will demand the thing to be changed. So I'm going to go ahead and play that. So here we go.
Saul Alinsky wrote the book Rules for Radicals. He wrote a book earlier called Reveille for Radicals. And our president, as a community organizer, which is the phrase started by Saul Alinsky, taught Solinsky's philosophies for several years in Chicago. Hillary Clinton wrote her paper, her thesis on Saul Alinsky, actually met the man, and he wanted her to come work with him, but she wanted to get involved in politics, and so she went off to Capitol Hill and worked as a staffer on Capitol Hill. Did you know that Saul Alinsky dedicated his book to none other than the very first rebel who rebelled, but at least won his own kingdom? Lucifer. Saul Alinsky dedicated his book to Lucifer. Our president has been teaching and following a man who dedicated his book to Satan. Do you think that there is a spiritual battle going on in America and around the world? Indeed there is. Well, what did Saul Alinsky say? Well, first of all, he talked about change on almost every page, and you thought our president came up with that phrase on his own. No, the word change is used by Alinsky on almost every page, and by change he means revolution. He also says an organizer working in and for an open society is in an ideological dilemma to begin with. He does not have a fixed truth. Truth to him is relative. Everything to him is relative. Kind of understand now why our president says one thing one day, one thing next day, or maybe in a few months. It's all based on whatever gets the job done. The first step in community organization is community disorganizing. Disorganization. In other words, Saul Alinsky said, penetrate the middle class, disorganize, and then reorganize. Penetrate the churches, he said. Have they penetrated our churches and our seminaries and our Christian colleges and our teachers' groups and our teachers' organizations? Absolutely. And Saul Alinsky said, this is what you must do. You see, Saul Alinsky studied a guy by the name of Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci was an Italian communist who told Mussolini, you're going about it all the wrong way. If you want a lasting revolution, you can't do it with guns and bullets. You got to get in there and you change their hearts and their minds. Their worldview is the foundation of their values. Their values is the foundation of their conduct. Change their worldview. They'll change their values and they'll change their conduct, and you've got a lasting revolution. But if you force it with guns and bullets, it won't last. Mussolini didn't like this and threw Gramsci in jail. Well, Saul Alinsky studied the writings of Gramsci and wrote Rules for Radicals. And so one of the things you do is you stir up dissatisfaction and discontent. And he says you pit the haves against the have-nots. You get class envy going. And that's what they're doing. And it's very, very sad. And they're also race baiting, which is also horrible. He goes on to say you'll be labeled an agitator, and that's exactly what you are. You agitate to the point of conflict. Standing behind President Clinton in this picture is the man in the gray suit. Standing next to him is his wife in the blue dress with the green sweater. This is a husband and wife. She kept her maiden name. Husband and wife by the name of Cloward and Piven, radical professors at Columbia University. They studied Saul Alinsky, and in 1966, they wrote an article in The Nation magazine saying, hey, let's implement socialism, and the way to do it is to collapse the economy. And the way to collapse the economy is to create more benefits, as many benefits as you can, new benefits, put as many people on those benefits as you can, overwhelm the system till you collapse it. They introduced this in New York, and I think they started out with about 150,000 people on the welfare. When they were done 10 years later, it was like 1.5 million. We began to talk about this in January or February, and we began to ask our radio audience to let other talk show hosts know about the Cloward Piven strategy. And within a few weeks, we have at least one talk show host on radio and television who began to talk extensively about the Cloward Piven strategy. See, my friends, they're deliberately collapsing our economy. And there was a man by the name of George Riley who read this article, and he began to talk to a guy named Wade Rathke. Wade Rathke started an organization in Arkansas committed to doing this. The A in his organization stood for Arkansas. It worked so well, they changed the A to association, and you now know it is ACORN. Based on this philosophy of Saul Alinsky and the Cloward Piven strategy.
Okay, so that was, I don't know exactly who that was. I wasn't able to sort of determine that. But in any case, you know, it's interesting, and they're talking about how to overwhelm the system and so on and so forth. And it's obviously being implemented. But again, it goes back to our morals, you know, because if you have enough people in the society that are truly moral, and they, you know, genuinely moral, then these things won't work. But if you have large segments that won't face themselves, then it becomes possible for, you can think of these people sort of as germs, sort of invading germs, you know, and the lack of morals is sort of a poor immune system. And so the germs simply take over the immune, you know, take over because the immune system can't fight it. So there you go. So I've got a couple of, I'm going to go ahead and play these other two pieces of audio. While I was poking around, I found this, you know, it's a short piece of audio. Milton Friedman was being interviewed by Phil Donahue, and so I thought this was pretty interesting. So this is Milton Friedman being interviewed, the economist, Milton Friedman being interviewed by Phil Donahue.
When you see around the globe the maldistribution of wealth, the desperate plight of millions of people in underdeveloped countries, when you see so few haves and so many have-nots, when you see the greed and the concentration of power within, did you ever have a moment of doubt about capitalism and whether greed's a good idea to run on?
Well, first of all, tell me, is there some society you know that doesn't run on greed? You think Russia doesn't run on greed? You think China doesn't run on greed? What is greed? Of course, none of us are greedy. It's only the other fellow who's greedy. The world runs on individuals pursuing their separate interests. The great achievements of civilization have not come from government bureaus. Einstein didn't construct his theory under order from a bureaucrat. Henry Ford didn't revolutionize the automobile industry that way. In the only cases in which the masses have escaped from the kind of grinding poverty you're talking about, the only cases in recorded history are where they have had capitalism and largely free trade. If you want to know where the masses are worst off, it's exactly in the kinds of societies that depart from that. So that the record of history is absolutely crystal clear. That there is no alternative way, so far discovered, of improving the lot of the ordinary people that can hold a candle to the productive activities that are unleashed by a free enterprise system.
But it seems to reward not virtue as much as ability to manipulate the system.
And what does reward virtue? You think the communist commissar rewards virtue? You think a Hitler rewards virtue? You think, excuse me, if you'll pardon me, do you think American presidents reward virtue? Do they choose their appointees on the basis of the virtue of the people appointed or on the basis of their political clout? Is it really true that political self-interest is nobler somehow than economic self-interest? You know, I think you're taking a lot of things for granted. And just tell me where in the world you find these angels who are going to organize society for us. Well, I don't even trust you to do that.
Okay, so that was Milton Friedman talking, or you know, being interviewed on the old Phil Donahue show. And of course, Phil Donahue, you know, he was a liberal. I think he's still alive. I don't think he, you know, but he, you know, he's long since not been on television anymore, or kind of in, you know, anywhere in the public eye. But nonetheless, he was liberal, but he had some interesting guests on there and some very interesting exchanges. You know, in the past, I've played, Donahue had Ayn Rand on there a couple of times, and they were very interesting programs, and I've played those in the past. So finally, I've got this final piece of audio, and this is a former KGB agent being interviewed, I may have played this audio in the past, but it's certainly worth listening to. Again, this KGB agent was talking about how communism was essentially, it was planned to sort of take over, you know, how to take over a country, and so on and so forth. So let me go ahead and play that. So here we go.
Our conversation is with Mr. Yuri Alexandrovich Bezmianov. Mr. Bezmianov was born in 1939. In a suburb of Moscow. He was the son of a high-ranking Soviet Army officer. He was educated in the elite schools inside the Soviet Union and became an expert in Indian culture and Indian languages. He had an outstanding career with Novosti, which was the, and still is, I should say, the press arm or the press agency of the Soviet Union. It turns out that this is also a front for the KGB. He escaped to the West in 1970 after becoming totally disgusted with the Soviet system, and he did this at great risk to his life. He certainly is one of the world's outstanding experts on the subject of Soviet propaganda and disinformation and active measures. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the process which is legitimate, overt, and open. You can see it with your own eyes. All you have to do, all American mass media has to do, is to unplug their bananas from their ears, open up their eyes, and they can see it. There is no mystery. There is nothing to do with espionage. I know that espionage intelligence gathering looks more romantic. It sells more deodorants through the advertising, probably. That's why your Hollywood producers are so crazy about James Bond type of thrillers. But in reality, the main emphasis of the KGB is not in the area of intelligence at all. According to my opinion and opinion of many defectors of my caliber, only about 15% of time, money and manpower is spent on espionage as such. The other 85% is a slow process which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages. The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already. For the last 25 years, actually it's over-fulfilled because demoralization now reaches such areas where previously not even Comrade Andropov and all his experts would would even dream of such a tremendous success. Most of it is done by Americans to Americans, thanks to lack of moral standards. As I mentioned before, exposure to true information does not matter anymore. A person who was demoralized is unable to assess true information. The facts tell nothing to him. Even if I shower him with information, with authentic proof, with documents, with pictures, even if I take him by force to the Soviet Union and show him concentration camp, he will refuse to believe it until he is going to receive a kick in his fat bottom. When a military boot crashes his, then he will understand, but not before that. That's the tragic of the situation of demoralization. So the next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby, doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, it's what matters is essentials: economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense and economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast. The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now. And after crisis, with a violent change of power structure and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 68, Comrade Brezhnev said, "Now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized." This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C., with benevolent dictators like Walter Mondale, who will promise lots of things, never mind whether the promises are fulfillable or not. Your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist-Lenin has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot. But they may turn into the most bitter enemies of Marxist-Leninists when they come to power. And that's what happened in Nicaragua. You remember most of these former Marxist-Leninists were either put to prison or one of them split, and now he's working against Sandinistas. It happened in Grenada when Maurice Bishop was already a Marxist. He was executed by a new Marxist who was more Marxist than this Marxist. Same happened in Afghanistan when first there was Taraki, he was killed by Amin, then Amin was killed by Babrak Karmal with the help of KGB. Same happened in Bangladesh when Mujibur Rahman, very pro-Soviet leftist, was assassinated by his own Marxist-Leninist military comrades. It's the same pattern everywhere. It's divided in four basic stages: demoralization, destabilization, crisis, normalization.
Okay, so that was that piece of audio, and I think that you can see that the man knew what he was talking about, and we're sort of in the kind of the latter stages of it. So, but the first step is demoralization, and that step is complete, and you just kind of listen to what he had to say and sort of figure out where we're at. But he clearly stated that you know, once someone is demoralized, the facts no longer matter. You can put the facts right in front of them and they can't see it. They won't see it. So, in any case, it's I find it all fascinating. So, anyway, I think I'm going to go ahead and cut this off, get this uploaded, and see if I can't get headed towards bed. Hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.